It's 1861 and the war is upon us. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, how a small town played its role in the battle to save the Union. Historians William Bartelt and Ryan Rokihi are authors of The War is Upon Us, New Harmony, Indiana, and the Civil War. We'll hear how Robert Dale Owen, a political reformer and wartime statesman, had the ear of President Lincoln, providing advice and counsel. There's also Owen's younger brother, Richard, who commands a POW camp for Confederates and, ironically, is later captured by the rebels. And the good and brave soldier, Captain James Penn Bennett, his letters home to his wife and children, and a final letter that foreshadowed his death. 2 Main Street is next, presented by the Berger Wren Group at Baird Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street as we look back at our nation's history, 250 years and counting. But we almost didn't make it to 100 years. The Civil War threatened the future of the United States of America, North versus South, incredible carnage on both sides, and even family members taking arms against each other. Well, that's the big picture, but in a new book, The War is Upon Us, we see how the Civil War impacts a small border town, and we meet the key players in this life and death drama to preserve the Union. My guests are William Bartelt and Ryan Rokihi, authors of The War is Upon Us, New Harmony, Indiana, and the Civil War. So welcome, gentlemen, to 2 Main Street.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Good to have you here. Now, so a great cast of characters in the book. Robert Dale Owen, of course, Richard Owen, his younger brother, right? And Captain James Bennett, each worthy of a chapter in The War is Upon Us. But first, let's get a snapshot of New Harmony, Indiana, before the start of the Civil War. Understand, in the book, you mentioned hogs running wild in the streets. So what was that all about?
Well, that was the normal thing in most towns at that time. Hogs would run wild in the streets, and that wasn't always a negative thing because the people would throw kitchen scraps out and things, so it was a way of disposing of their garbage as well. Okay. But it was a nuisance. They would dig mud holes in the street and things of that sort. So in New Harmony in 1861, they outlawed the hogs, so there were no more hogs in the street, but they still had wild horses, and the paper talked that they should outlaw the horses also because they were topping the new trees they were planting. Plus, it was scaring the little children.
Oh, well, okay. That makes sense. Now, what was the population like, Ryan, in the early, well, I guess in the mid-19th century?
About 700 to 800, about like it is today, as a matter of fact.
Really hasn't changed a whole lot then.
Not a whole lot.
So were there any free blacks in New Harmony?
Yes, there certainly were.
And what were the occupations in New Harmony then?
Blacksmith, the one gentleman that we have a very solid record for, was a blacksmith in New Harmony.
Mm-hmm. Agriculture still big, of course?
It was an agricultural town. It was serving the farmers in the area.
Mm-hmm. Now, people made money doing that. Now, there was also a newspaper called The Advertiser, and for that small population, that's kind of amazing.
Yes. Well, New Harmony was a unique town. Because of its history, it was a typical Southern Indiana town in some ways, but the client, the citizens, were probably more educated and more aware of what was happening in the world, and so it's only logical that they would have a newspaper that dealt with that. Plus, it was one of the few towns around by that time that had a library.
Absolutely, the history of New Harmony, of course, is very important, very interesting, founded in 1814 by Father George Rapp, part of a Lutheran sect, a German Lutheran sect. They were in Pennsylvania for a while before deciding to move to Indiana. They needed a place that was better climate for growing grapes, for their wine, and, of course, being a religious sect, they came to the Wabash River to await Christ's return. But when that did not happen, they moved back to Pennsylvania. But in that time period, between 1814 and 1825, they were very productive. Made wine, agricultural produce. They were trading all over the Midwest, out to St. Louis, down to New Orleans in the South. When they moved back to Pennsylvania, they sold the land to Robert Owen, who was wanting to embark on a socialist utopian experiment.
He wanted a boatload of knowledge. Right?
Yes, the boatload of knowledge was part of that. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So when the socialist experiment kind of died within 2 years, a lot of the same people stayed. Speaking of the boatload of knowledge, they brought William McClure, the president of the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia before coming over. Thomas Say, a naturalist, a lot of educators, and Owen's sons, of course. They stayed behind and built a legacy of education, science inquiry, scientific inquiry, and which really lasted up to the time of the Civil War.
Yeah. I know we talk about, we'll talk a lot about Robert Dale Owen here in a little bit. Now, I thought this was very interesting. In 1860, politics seemed to be the order of the day. That's what the Advertiser reported in 1860. And the campaigning, I thought this was interesting, who had the banner on the tallest flagpole? That was a big deal then. The candidates were Lincoln, Douglas, and Breckinridge.
Right. And actually, there was a fourth candidate as well who didn't have much support in New Harmony, but that was a Constitutional Union Party,
yes,
which was sort of a compromise party. Lincoln said it was like being for fair weather. It was a Constitutional Union.
Yeah.
But Lincoln was the Republican candidate. The Democratic Party split, and the front runner early on was Stephen Douglas of Illinois. But he had said some things in the Lincoln-Douglas debate a couple years earlier that concerned some of the Southern people, that he wasn't quite as pro-slavery as they wanted him to be. So there was a split, and so you have two Democratic parties. Douglas is the Northern Democratic Party, and John Breckinridge, the Southern Democratic Party. And interestingly enough, John Breckinridge's running mate was Joseph Lane. And Joseph Lane had lived in Vandenberg County in his early years, was very important early on, and was a good friend of Robert Dale Owen. He, at this point, was the senator from Oregon Territory. And many people wanted him to be a presidential candidate. In New Harmony, it was basically between Lincoln and Douglas.
And Douglas got the most votes, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
Over Lincoln.
Yes, yes.
Who grew up in southern Indiana.
Yep.
Okay, there we go. Okay. Okay, now let's learn more about one of the pillars of the community, Robert Dale Owen. We mentioned him earlier, a Scottish immigrant described as a reformer politician, wartime statesman. He came to the U.S. as a young man on the boatload of knowledge, and he was elected to the state legislature, served in Congress, became charge d'affaires to the two kingdoms of Sicily. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that's actually before Italy was unified.
Okay.
So this was the southern part, Naples and Sicily, were the two kingdoms of Sicily. He's there in the 1850s, and then it's in 1860, 61, that Italy is unified. So that existed, I think, between 1816 and 1861.
So he lived in Naples then?
I'm not sure where he lived, but probably.
We don't see his name.
But he, and then after that ended, he spent time in Europe and traveled in Europe and became well known with many of the people in Europe. Mm-hmm.
Now, there's President Pierce, I think, appointed him as to the Sicily position.
Yeah, and that kind of goes back to that, back to Joseph Lane. And Joseph Lane was appointed general in the Mexican War, mm-hmm, through the efforts of Robert Dale Owen, who was a member of Congress. And then when Lane was a member of Congress, he kind of finagled to get Robert Dale Owen appointed to this diplomatic position.
It's still who you know, isn't it? It really is. So he definitely had some government gravitas going into the Civil War. Now, Owen, we said, was a Democrat. Abraham Lincoln, a Republican. But Owen had Lincoln's ear, didn't he?
Yes. That's a gradual thing to some degree. Owen was not a Lincoln supporter early on. Owen actually was in Europe, comes back in 1860. So Owen didn't take part in the campaign of 1860. But once the campaign was over, he was very much concerned about what was happening in the country. And when the South began to withdraw, he was an advocate of compromise, saying, you know, you don't like slavery, I don't like slavery, but the choice either is compromising with slavery or not having a union. And so he was very much in favor of compromising, which Lincoln was not. But once the war starts, once Fort Sumter's fired upon, then he becomes very much a war Democrat and is very supportive of the war, and gets connected with the Lincoln administration. In 1861, the states had to pretty much provide all of the equipment and things for their soldiers. And so the idea was they're probably going to have to go to Europe to get this equipment. And so Governor Oliver P. Morton of Indiana needed somebody who, someone who knew Europe, who had contacts, was a businessman of sorts. And if he was a war Democrat, that's all the better.
So Owen became an arms dealer?
He became the person who acquired almost all of the arms, not just the arms, but also the blankets and the uniforms and all that sort of thing. And in the process, he becomes well known to the Lincoln administration, particularly the Secretary of War Stanton and the Secretary of Treasury Chase.
Now, Ryan, did Lincoln ever campaign in Posey County?
No, he did not.
He did not? Did he have any surrogates?
Well, he certainly had surrogates because he had a very large flagpole there in New Harmony.
Somebody was supporting him.
Absolutely,
I think they had a Lincoln committee or something like that.
Yes, they did. Mm-hmm. They did. Just wasn't enough to win that election in 1860, though, unfortunately.
Okay, now, also Robert Dale Owen, this guy, very interesting. He was deep into spiritualism, wasn't he? So how did that go over?
Well, he really starts that when he's in Europe, and he writes a book. Actually, it's one of the first attempts to really explain spiritualism. Spiritualism was a big deal at this time, and it especially became even bigger during the Civil War. And the idea is that you could communicate with the people who, your loved ones who were dead. And he believed in it, and he wrote several books on the topic. It kind of comes to a bad end, though, and toward the end of his life, he gets involved in the what's called the Katy King incident, where Katy King was in was someone, a spirit that was brought forth in Philadelphia, and people were very critical and skeptical, and Owen totally endorsed the whole thing. And then when it was proven a hoax, he was very much embarrassed by it. But there were a lot of people. Mary Todd Lincoln really believed in spiritualism.
Right.
And I've always been curious, but I've never found that there was any discussion between Lincoln and Robert Dale Owen. But it seems to me his wife was very much involved in it. And here you had the most well-known advocate of it. I can't imagine that Lincoln and he didn't have some conversations about spiritualism.
Oh, that'd be some good research, wouldn't it?
They must have.
Because they probably crossed paths, you know, in the White House.
Oh, well, we know they did.
Yeah, definitely. Now, of course, he married again late in life, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't live much longer after other marriage.
Yeah, he actually, after this Katy King thing, he had a nervous breakdown, and he spent 3 months in a mental institution in Indianapolis in 1875. And then in 1876, he remarried and died in 1877 in New York.
Now, there's a 200-pound limestone bust of Owen placed outside the Indiana State Capitol. The women of Indiana honoring Owen, but that monument disappeared. That's a mystery.
Well, not all of it.
Oh.
It was on a 70-inch high pedestal, and then you had the bust on the top. And this was put in the early 1900s. Owen was a real advocate for women's rights. When he was in the legislature, when he was part of writing the current Indiana Constitution in 1851, he was an advocate of women's rights. And so in appreciation, the women put up that monument. It's on the south side of the Capitol building on the Washington Street side. And the bust the work of a woman artist. It got a lot of attention. And then the bust disappeared in the 1970s. So if you go up there now, you still see that pedestal with the information about him. You just don't see him. And I think that's interesting that if you really study Robert Dale Owen, you see he had a lot of influence that you don't see. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of like that bust. You don't see Robert Dale Owen, but you see some of the results of what he did in his life.
So, Ryan, what kind of memorabilia did you have of Robert Dale Owen at the Working Men's Institute?
We have a lot of correspondence, a lot of papers relating to Owen. We also have a lot of geological specimens and scientific equipment in our collection that was related to him as well.
Yeah, he was really big into science, wasn't he?
Absolutely.
Definitely. What a fascinating character. My guests are William Bill Bartelt and Ryan Rokicki, co-authors of The War is Upon Us, New Harmon, Indiana, and the Civil War. Still to come, another Owen does his part in the Civil War effort, Robert Dale Owen's younger brother, Richard. He's remembered for his military service. There's a great story about Richard Owen being a commandant of a camp for Confederate prisoners and later becoming a POW of the Confederates. What an irony. You can't make this up. And later, the letters home from Captain James Penn Bennett, a good and brave officer. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. New Harmony is marking the bicentennial of the Robert Owen, William McClure experiment to create a community of equality. The boatload of knowledge was actually a keelboat named the Philanthropist. It carried educators, scientists, and artists from Pittsburgh down the Ohio River to New Harmony. This was in the winter of 1825 and 1826. During the month-long journey, the boat became a floating university, with passengers giving lectures, studying the geology, and sharing their knowledge. Among the passengers was Thomas Say, recognized as the father of American entomology. He was elected captain of the Philanthropist. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. We are remembering the Civil War, a defining moment in our nation's 250-year history, and its impact on a small Indiana community. Bill Bartelt and Ryan Rokicki are authors of The War is Upon Us, New Harmony, Indiana, and the Civil War, published by MT Publishing. Now, we talked about the role of Robert Dale Owen, reformer politician and wartime statesman, but before we look at the military adventures of his younger brother, Richard, let's learn more about my guests. William Bill Bartelt is a Lincoln historian, and his books include There I Grew Up, about Lincoln's boyhood in southern Indiana. Bill has also written histories about one of the tri-state's oldest churches, Trinity United Methodist. Ryan Rokicki is executive director of the Working Men's Institute Museum and Library in New Harmony. So, Ryan, tell us about the Institute, its history, and what goes on there.
The WMI, or the Working Men's Institute, is the oldest continuously operating library in Indiana. We were founded in 1838 by William McClure, okay, Robert Owen's partner in the Community of Equality in 1826, 1827. McClure felt that education only benefited the elite, and that there was no place for the common laboring class to gain useful information. He thought the working class, they don't need Greek and Latin and rhetoric and all these topics being discussed at the university. They need practical information, information that they could apply to their jobs, to their families, to their day-to-day life. So that was the idea behind the Working Men's Institute. Started off as a library, a holding place for information, but they also had lectures and workshops, and the men would gather and they would talk about the latest developments in agriculture or practice skills like blacksmithing and things like that, all for the betterment of the community. So we've been in continuous existence since 1838. We've been in our present building since 1894, and we're still a public library. Over the years, we have become New Harmony's attic. We have a vast collection of museum objects, archival manuscripts. We have some art as well. And with our museum, our public library, and the public programming that we still do, we're still rocking and rolling in New Harmony.
Now, Bill, being a Lincoln scholar, of course, so much has been written about Abe. Are we still learning more about Abe's life and legacy? Are we still uncovering new information?
Well, we are, but we're also reinterpreting information. Oh, okay. So some things that maybe didn't seem significant at one point, today they may be. So there is new information, and also many times you're looking at very, very small activities, very small incidents, and seeing the significance of them. But yeah, there are more books published about Lincoln than any other person.
Now, the boyhood of Abe, of course, very important to this area.
It is.
Growing up in southern Indiana, and his formative years, right?
They were. You know, I always, when I'm asked about that, my standard response is think in your own life, when you were 7 and when you were 21, and how important those years were in shaping you, making you who you are today. And we can say the same about Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. And by the way, Josh Claiborne and I are writing another book that's going to be published by the University of Illinois Press, which deals with that Kentucky and Indiana period. And we really try to look at that and see how important it was. And I think the working title of the book is Making Lincoln, the Formative Years of Abraham Lincoln. So we'll see. But yeah, we're still looking at it. And the Indiana period really has been overlooked to a large degree. So we're trying to make that better known and see the importance of that period of time in Lincoln's life.
Now, Ryan, you were curator of collections at the National Museum of Civil War Medicine in Frederick, Maryland.
Correct.
That has to be an incredible place. There were some 60,000 amputations, I think, during the Civil War.
Yes.
And also disease killed a lot of soldiers. So tell me about some of the collections in that museum.
That museum's collections tell the entire medical and surgical history of the Civil War, 1861 to 1865. It has a wonderful collection of medical instruments. We have manuscripts and diaries, or rather they have manuscripts and diaries telling the perspective of the patients, the doctors, the nurses. We know the Civil War was the bloodiest war in American history, some 640,000 and well over 1 million wounded. But a story that's not told often is what was done with those wounded. And Frederick was chosen as a location for that because in 1862, Frederick became one vast hospital because of the Antietam campaign. The Battle of Antietam, just a few miles away, west of Frederick, all the wounded, the Union wounded and Confederate wounded, were taken to the hospitals in Frederick, Maryland.
You have photographs too, don't they?
Yes, absolutely.
And the surgeons, the work that they had to perform, just amazing. And I know you have those kits that they carried around too, didn't they? The
yes.
Amputation kits.
Yes. Amputation was necessary at the time, especially in the field hospitals during a battle. A surgeon does not have X-ray equipment in the 1860s. He doesn't have time to spend... doesn't have a lot of time to spend on one patient because he's got 4 other people waiting out in the barnyard to get treatment as well. So amputation is the best way to treat a soldier at a time. It was not done out of ignorance. It was done because of the success rate and because of the time allotted. Mm-hmm. The Civil War bullets at that time, they didn't pierce the bone like modern bullets do. They shattered the bone in a compound comminuted fracture. So that bone is in multiple... pieces. It's splintered. Well, you don't have X-rays to go in there and find that in 1863. You don't have the titanium alloy pins to piece that back together. And you know, if you do nothing, there's going to be an infection because you didn't quite understand germs yet. And the patient's going to die of gangrene or something else. So the best way to save the life is to remove the limb.
There's also kind of a tribute to Clara Barton, too, at the Frederick, right?
Yes, yes. She was a great organizer, known as a nurse, but she was a great organizer helping get supplies and just bringing awareness to the plight of the wounded and the sick soldiers.
Mm-hmm. Now let's go back to the book and learn more about the military career of Richard Owen. Now, he served in the Mexican-American War, and he taught at a military school as well?
Yeah, he was a real educator. And even when he was in the Mexican War, they would talk about how he was trying to learn Spanish. And when he was on maneuvers in the Mexican and Civil War, he would stop and check out the hillsides and the geology and was actually his brother, David Dale Owen, was a state geologist. And after he died, then Richard was for a while the state geologist. So, and he did teach at military schools in Kentucky and in Tennessee.
Now, he was also the commandant of Camp Morton in Indianapolis for Confederate POWs. And he was a colonel, and his philosophy, was treat prisoners humanely.
It was. We probably should say something about prisoners of war, especially early on in the war. Neither side had the money or the facilities to have long-time prisoners of war. So they kind of followed the procedure, I guess, in Europe, that if you were captured, you would be held for a while, the information about you would be obtained, and you would sign a statement that you would not fight again until there was someone on the other side was exchanged. So it was, but if you were an officer, they had to have a lot more privates exchanged and so forth. So these prisoner of war camps many times were temporary, you know, maybe several months or whatever. And that was the case here in Indianapolis. Now, that would change after 1863 when the Confederates do not treat African Americans as prisoners of war. And so the North stops this prisoner exchange, not only for that reason, but also that the North can afford to have their people taken out of the battle, and the South can't. And so it's going to hurt the South if all the people captured are stayed in the prisoner of war camp. But Owen was very humane to these people. He built a bakery, for example, so they could have good bread. He actually was so sympathetic to them, and he got in trouble sometime by the state officials and some of the people in Indianapolis who felt that he was too kind to them, and they were a threat to him. But he was well respected, and when he was only there for a few months, I think, maybe February to June, before he was sent back into battle. And when it was decided that he was going to leave, the inmates there petitioned to try to keep him.
Yeah. And the irony is that Colonel Owen goes back into combat, and yes, he becomes a prisoner of war himself.
He does.
How did that happen?
Well, he was the 60th, I think it was to guard a bridge at Mumford, Kentucky. And he was attacked, and they lost. And so he and his men were taken as prisoner. Now, the real irony of it is that many of the people that captured him had been his former students in these military schools in Kentucky, and some of them had been the prisoners in Indianapolis. So they were very kind to him and allowed him to keep his weapons and things. And then he was paroled and sent back to Indianapolis to wait an exchange. And then after that, of course, he was back into the battle.
Do you have any Richard Owen memorabilia at the Working Men's Institute?
Yes, we do. We do have some correspondence of his as well, and some of his scientific collection.
Well,
as well.
Right, yeah.
Yes. So we have some of his books. We have a lot of his military manuals. He needed infantry tactics, books on military procedure. We have those in our rare book collection, and we can open them up and see Colonel Richard Owen.
That's cool. That's so cool. Now, okay, after the war, he becomes a professor. He returned to New Harmony. We talked about his love of science. He was, yes, part of that boatload of knowledge. Now, there's a memorial to Richard.
I don't think he was. Richard was not part of the boatload.
Oh, I guess it's the legacy of the boatload.
Right. Absolutely.
There,
absolutely,
we go, yeah. Now, there's a memorial to Richard Owen from those Confederate soldiers at Camp Morton. Did they have a memorial to him?
Not at the time, but 50 years later, in the early 1900s, some of the people who remembered him took up a collection. And they had commissioned a bust of Richard, which they presented to the state. So Richard's bust is inside the Indiana State Capitol, and Robert's bust is gone on the outside of the Capitol.
Okay. All right. My guests are Bill Bartelt and Ryan Rokicki, authors of The War is Upon Us, New Harmony, Indiana, and the Civil War. Still to come, the incredible letters home from a good and brave officer, Captain James Penn Bennett. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. New Harmony's Richard Owen was promoted to colonel of the 60th Indiana Volunteers and was assigned to guard prisoners of war at Camp Morton in Indianapolis. Here's Colonel Owen's description of the Confederate soldiers. The privates and non-commissioned officers were mostly small farmers or squatters from Mississippi, Kentucky, and Tennessee. They presented a shabby and forlorn appearance. Almost a year after the firing on Fort Sumter, it was still rare to find any kind of uniform among the prisoners. Occasionally, a man would have an army blanket, either from England or plundered from a former U.S. Army post. Most of the men had a bundle of odds and ends, sometimes a bag of coffee or a slab of bacon. Few had any extra clothing, and an overcoat was unheard of. Camp Morton was located on the Indiana State Fairgrounds. It became a training ground for Union volunteers in 1861. But following Union victories at Shiloh and Fort Donelson, the camp was repurposed to house thousands of Confederate prisoners. After the departure of Colonel Owen, it was reported the conditions became worse for the POWs, and at the end of the war, some 17,000 soldiers died at Camp Morton. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you are just joining us, we are learning how a small community in Indiana played its role in the war to save the Union. My guests are Bill Bartelt and Ryan Rokicki, authors of The War is Upon Us, New Harmony, Indiana, and the Civil War. Now, we've talked about the history of New Harmony, learned about the politician, reformer, and wartime statesman Robert Dale Owen and his younger brother, Colonel Richard Owen, who was in charge of a POW camp in Indianapolis and later became a POW himself. There's another New Harmony player in this drama, Captain James Penn Bennett. The book features letters to his wife, Mary, giving us an idea of what everyday life was like for a Union soldier. Bennett, who was an officer, was conscious of the conduct of his men. No looting or pillaging, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
A good and brave guy, right?
Yes. When the Civil War begins, the regular army of the United States is less than 15,000 individuals. So Lincoln's calls for volunteers is heated throughout the land, and in small communities all throughout the North, they start raising companies for infantry, cavalry, and artillery. And the first unit raised in New Harmony was the New Harmony Rifles there in that April of 1861. And James Penn Bennett, who was a school teacher and former a librarian at the Working Men's Institute, he was elected first sergeant. And within a year, he was an officer, second lieutenant. But he left a wonderful record, writing not only to his wife, Mary, but to his children. He had a daughter, Jeanette, about 14 years old when he enlisted, a son, Shelley, about 9 or 10 years old, and then his younger son, Percy, who would have been about 6 years old when his father marched off to war in 1861.
Then you have, how many letters do you have?
We have about 30 letters in the collection.
Really?
From Captain Bennett, and several letters from the family as well.
I'm wondering about the correspondence back then. They write these letters in the field. How long does it take for this letter to get back home?
Not too long.
Really?
The Army mail system was very quick. Now, sometimes that could depend on where the soldiers were, if they were deep in enemy territory. Bennett, when he is writing from Union-held Memphis in 1862 to 1863, the letters are going straight home, right up the Mississippi into the Ohio. Within a matter of days, they would get to New Harmony.
That's amazing. That really is.
But later on, when he is in the Meridian Campaign of 1864, deep in the heart of Mississippi, no letters are coming from New Harmony to him, and he's sending letters out, but he knows it's probably going to be weeks before they get home.
And you talk in the book about money being sent home.
Yes. A lot of families lost their source of income when their husbands and fathers signed up for the Army. So it was very important to get the money that they could get from the from their army pay, send that back home to support the family.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a prophetic line in his last letter to Mary before he was arriving in Atlanta. Bennett writes, "There is more danger in straggling than fighting on the skirmish line." And that turned out to be quite true, didn't it?
Yes, it did. When he wrote that letter later that day, he was killed by a Confederate bullet on the outskirts of Atlanta. It may have been a stray bullet as well.
Oh, really?
Because the rifle pits, the skirmish lines, they were always trading fire. And when Bennett was, he was not on duty at the in the rifle pits at that time. He was back finishing up dinner. So it might have been a stray bullet. Could have been a sniper with a very, very long scope on the end of his sharpshooter's rifle. But it's hard to say.
Could have been friendly fire?
No, not from the direction it came
from. Okay, all right. But after his death, he was promoted to captain, right?
Yes.
His body was later returned to New Harmony, is that right?
Yes. We have correspondence that suggests that the body was found in about 1866-67, and he has his marker right there in the cemetery in New Harmony.
That had to be an incredible process of returning these bodies to their hometowns. Wow.
It did. One of the first one was John Hyman, who was killed in 1861. He was from New Harmony, lived south of New Harmony, and was killed in Missouri, at Fredericktown, Missouri. Mm-hmm. And his body was brought back, and the Evansville papers have a long description of the funeral. It was like they started at his house, which was like 4 miles south of New Harmony, and the procession was 4 miles long. All these people, and because it was the first one, and as time went on, I'm sure they became less elaborate. But it's interesting to read that account.
Whatever happened to Mary Bennett?
She lived in New Harmony.
Rest of her life.
Rest of her life, and was remembered as one of the mothers of New Harmony.
I bet.
A kind soul.
And you have a portrait of Captain Bennett?
Yes, we do. James Poindexter painted that portrait, and it hangs in the library of the Working Men's Institute. That was donated by the captain's grandson, who he never met, of course, Shelley Bennett Jr., and Shelley's mother.
And yeah. It's in the book.
It's in the book. Yeah.
I understand there were some 24,000 Union deaths in Indiana, and of course, many more sick and wounded. And we talked about one of the first deaths from New Harmony was Captain John Hyman with the 1st Indiana Cavalry.
Yes.
And he was serving in Missouri. And there's a soldier's row at Bellefontaine Cemetery in Mount Vernon?
Yes.
Okay. And is that where Hyman's buried there?
I think he's buried in New Harmony.
He is.
Oh, he's in
Uncle Hyman is buried in Maple Hill Cemetery in New Harmony.
There's some interesting people, too, also. General Alvin Hovey?
Yes.
He was, he's buried in Posey County as well. There were the companies D and F of the 25th Indiana Infantry?
Yes. The 25th, that was the... Bennett's company was Company A in the 25th, but several other Posey County companies came.
And the 1st Indiana Cavalry, was that Hyman? Was he with that group?
Yes, okay. Company A and Company C came from Posey County.
I understand also some Confederate soldiers are buried at Bellefontaine Cemetery.
Yes, a few.
That's interesting.
Probably from the hospitals, right?
Yes.
Because especially after Shiloh, they put the wounded, both Union and Confederate, on boats and took them up the Mississippi and Ohio, and they stopped at every town along the way to see if they would take. And Evansville had, four or five hospitals. Hmm. And that's why there are people buried out at Oak Hill in Evansville who are Confederates, because they died in the hospitals here in Evansville.
Now, when the war is over, and Johnny comes marching home, what was the reception for these soldiers in New Harmony?
I think everyone was relieved. Everyone was joyful that the war was over. But, of course, that joy is quickly quashed when Abraham Lincoln is assassinated.
Yeah, on April 14th. Yeah, and there was elaborate funeral ceremonies in New Harmony after he was assassinated. But Richard Owen, I think, gave a speech shortly after that at a reception for the returning soldiers. And he talks about how important it was, the work that the home front was doing, how important that was to the soldiers, sending them things, you know, clothing or whatever, but also to supporting the soldiers' families and supporting the hospitals. You know, the local people, the women especially, donated clothing and things to these hospitals, and we have a record of some of the things that were donated by New Harmony, as well as money to try to help the soldiers who were wounded and were recovering. And I think one of the interesting things, Mrs. Owen donated pie plant. Well, pie plant is rhubarb. And so I don't know how much she, but she donated some of her rhubarb to the cause.
And that's recorded.
Yes, in the Evansville newspapers, they write who was giving these things. So, yeah.
Well, the home front during the war is interesting, too. I mean, you know, we're close to Kentucky. And were there any Southern sympathizers in New Harmony?
Well, there were. But you have to understand, there were people who were not happy with the Lincoln administration. But once the war started, the people of New Harmony, for the most part, were pro-Union. And so they were very willing to go off and fight for the Union. That changes after 1863, after the Emancipation Proclamation. And now it's a war not just for the Union, but it's a war for emancipation. And many of these people said, you know, I'm very happy to fight for the Union, but I'm not going to fight for freeing the slaves. Hmm. And so there was quite a bit of opposition, Copperhead opposition and so forth. And the Democratic Party, their slogan was, the Constitution as it is, the Union as it was. In other words, they were fighting not to change the Constitution as we see these Civil War amendments come up. And they were very happy to go back and having slavery. They wanted the Union restored. And if it was going to be restored the way it was in 1860, that was fine with them. And of course, the Republicans didn't see it that way. It was a war for emancipation. And so it was not going to be the Union as it was. It was going to be a new Union.
Interesting on Emancipation Proclamation. I think in the book you talk about Robert Dale Owen's possible influence with Lincoln in the drafting of the proclamation.
That's really what got me started on this whole project.
Really?
You know, I'm a student of Lincoln, and I have hundreds of Lincoln books, and I kept reading references to Robert Dale Owen. Just sentences or two. And so I really got curious what this was all about. So I started researching that and then realized that you can't talk about Robert Dale Owen in the Civil War without talking about New Harmony. And so Ryan, who I knew well, we discussed it. And there was another person, Terry Hughes, that was early on in the project. And for various reasons, he had to drop out. But we decided that we wanted to write this. Now, as I told you before, Robert L. Owen became well known in the Lincoln administration, and he became someone who was in favor of abolishing slavery. And so working with Secretary Stanton and Chase, who also felt this way, he wrote letters that they made sure Lincoln saw. There are two important letters. One is in early 1862 called The Way Out, where he says that the only way out of all this is to free the slaves and go on from that. And then there was another letter written in September. Lincoln saw these letters. Chase talks about how Lincoln found these letters to be very important. At this time, we have what we call the public letter. A lot of these letters that were written were not just written to go to the president, but they were written to be published. Oh. And Robert L. Owen's letters were all published in the newspapers, plus they even had a separate publication that came out later. So I don't know that Robert Dale Owen convinced Lincoln to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, but it supported, his views supported what Lincoln wanted. And Robert Dale Owen was a great wordsmith, and he could say it so much, and Lincoln even says this at one point, that he could say things better than Lincoln could. And Lincoln was a pretty darn good writer. So I think it was important to Lincoln to help build support for what he was doing with the public.
Mm-hmm. All right. Of course, New Harmony, just one of hundreds of communities contributing to the war effort. You're talking about in the book about they provided crops for the horses in the military. That was interesting. And, of course, marshaling the manpower and dealing with the sacrifices and losses during the Civil War. All that seems to be kind of a theme of the war is upon us, how this community rallied behind the war effort.
Yes.
Do you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. So many communities in the North and the South had similar experiences, but it's a little different in New Harmony just because of its history with the education mm-hmm. and the legacy that the fathers of New Harmony had built.
I think one of the interesting things in that is in the Evansville paper where they said that the young ladies of New Harmony would not support the men who didn't go to war. And so they were important in encouraging men to go to war to fight for the Union.
Mm-hmm. So how many, any idea how many like Posey County residents died in the Civil War or New Harmony residents?
There were about 150 New Harmony residents and in surrounding areas that that joined the Union Army. We know about 25 of them lost their lives, either through battle or disease.
Yeah, the whole idea about disease, I know that I went to the Lincoln Museum in Springfield, and they have that incredible exhibit about the casualties as it go through the war years, and just how many of those were disease-related. That is incredible.
Yes. If the Civil War had happened 10 years later, the casualty count probably wouldn't have been so high.
Wow.
Bacteria and germs, they had been seen under microscopes as far back as the 1600s, but nobody really put it together that these little organisms were causing anything until Louis Pasteur wanted to find out why his wine was spoiling. But the germ theory wouldn't really take off until the 1870s. So in the 1860s, you have a lot of disease, a lot of germs. Doctors really don't know what to do with. They're beginning to understand that cleanliness and sanitation has a positive effect, but they really don't understand the science behind that at this point.
Yeah, and you realize that there were, even in Evansville, there would be an open field, and a few months later, there would be hundreds of men camped out there for long periods of time. Mm-hmm. And think of the latrines and the horses and all just the filth that was there. And that's one of the things Richard Owen, and we're fortunate to be able to see a lot of his letters are at the Owen Mansion, which are not easily accessible. But he talks in there about how important it is to have order and cleanliness in the camps. It's understandable. And most of these, also realizing that most of these guys were farmers. They had not been exposed to the germs and so forth that somebody from New York would be. But now you put all these people together, mm-hmm. and so it was just an incubator for disease.
You have measles killing soldiers in 1861, childhood diseases running rampant throughout the camp. You have smallpox, all these things that in the civilian life, far away from population centers, didn't have to worry about so much. But as Bill says, they're camped together. Mm-hmm. It's a cesspool.
Post-war New Harmony, what was that like?
Well, it was, a typical southern Indiana town, I think. It
rebounded quickly?
I don't know the impact, except for the impact with people being gone and that sort of thing. I know one of the storekeepers, we have his journal, and during the war, it was so difficult to get things, and the things were so expensive that people wouldn't buy them. But all of that returned more to normal afterwards.
And the culture remained. The dances, the performances, the Minerva Society and the Debate Society meeting at the Working Men's Institute and the libraries, that all continued. And, of course, the Union veterans, they wanted to be remembered. They joined the Grand Army of the Republic, mm-hmm. the Veterans Organization, and the post in New Harmony was called the John Kell Hyman Post.
Okay.
In honor of of Captain Hyman.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, guys, this has been a fascinating conversation. My thanks to Bill Bartelt and Ryan Rokicki, authors of The War is Upon Us, New Harmony, Indiana, and the Civil War. A lot of local history there and some fascinating characters in the book. Thanks again for being my guests.
Thank you.
Thank you, David, so much.
The Civil War letters of Captain Bennett to his wife and children are a treasure and give us an intimate look at one soldier's journey. Here's part of a letter to his wife, Mary, when his unit arrived at Camp Veatch in St. Louis after leaving Camp Vandenberg by rail in August of 1861. The ride across Illinois was delightfully interesting to me. Although I got no sleep overnight, our men were excited with the anticipation of the journey, that no one scarcely could sleep, and I felt rather fatigued, yet my eyes were stretched to take in the vasting grandeur of the Great Prairie. After the Union victory at Fort Donelson in 1862, an optimistic Captain Bennett wrote his wife, "Victory is ours, and the war will soon close." But 2 years later, outside Atlanta, Captain Bennett writes his last letter saying there is more danger in straggling than fighting on the skirmish line. And on August 16, 1864, Mary Bennett receives word of her husband's death, a gunshot wound that caused instant death. A friend writes, saying, "I dressed him in his nice uniform and buried him in the best possible manner under the circumstances." The Civil War continued, and so did the death toll, between 620,000 and 750,000. That's about 2% of the U.S. population at the time. For every 3 soldiers killed in battle, 5 more died of disease. 1 in 4 soldiers who went to war never returned home. The new book, The War is Upon Us, gives us a snapshot of one small Indiana community and its contributions and sacrifices in the war to save the Union. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street.